This is episode 2 of The Poison Pen Letters, Who and Why, The Sinister Story Unravels.
In the last episode, we discovered the Reverend Emir Owen is the number one suspect in DC Gwynne Roberts' investigation into the sending of the deeply disturbing anonymous letters to some of the residents within the North Wales area. Gwynne had looked at many handwriting samples and compared them to the poison pen letters, but it was the inscription in a copy of the New Testament that led him to the prime suspect, the Reverend.
In this episode, we'll be talking about what happens next as Gwynne visits the Reverend to confront him.
So we'll hear from Gwynne about that first contact with the Reverend Owen.
Am I right in thinking that the phone call which you made and the Reverend Owen answered was about 8:15 on the 22nd of December 1984?
It was indeed, at which point I jumped in the car and made the 20-mile trip to Owen, and by 10 to 9 I was knocking his front door in company with a PC Edwards. Yes, I called at Towin Police Station, where I picked up Phil Edwards for the purpose of having a witness with me on the inquiry, and had I needed to seize any items, he would have been witness to that.
So you arrive at the address where the Reverend Emir Owen lives and knock the door, and what happens when you did that?
Which was opened by a 5'4" clergyman. I asked him, "Are you Emir Owen?" And he answered yes. He granted us entry into the house, and I saw a circular table in the lounge, the top of which was loaded with Christmas cards and envelopes. On 2 or 3, I saw the letter T from where I stood. Emir Owen was visibly nervous and repeatedly failed to make eye-to-eye contact initially. The 62-year-old, proportionately built minister stood before us, clad in a white shirt, brown tie and grey flannel trousers and black laced shoes. Initially, I asked him, "Is this your handwriting on the envelopes?" And he said, "Yes, why?" I said, "I'm making inquiries regarding the sending of anonymous letters to various people around the area."
So really, that was kind of your second breakthrough, because the first breakthrough was when you identified the endorsement in the book that you were given, and you knew that it had come from Emir Owen. And then now the second breakthrough is when you gain entry to his house. He invites you into his house, and you can see his Christmas cards and the Christmas cards that he's addressed to other people. And you can see that this is similar, the same writing that appeared in those very nasty anonymous letters that were sent to members of the community.
Yes, I could see the writing this time, where, as opposed to the letter T, the writing appeared the same to me. As I said, I told him the inquiries I was making, and he replied, "I know nothing about that." And I asked him, "Would you have a look at this New Testament? Is this your handwriting on the cover?" And I showed him the New Testament, which the man had early given me, and he said yes. At that point, I said to him, "It's my belief you're responsible for writing those anonymous letters too," and I named the persons concerned and I cautioned him. His reply was, "May the good Lord strike me dead. I have not written such letters, never." And he was looking at his feet again.
So his first reaction was just to deny the allegation that you were putting to him?
That's correct. And in answer to his reply, I said, "You're a man of the cloth and should know better than to say such things as 'God strike you dead.' The handwriting in the letters and the handwriting in the testament is identical to even the unqualified like myself." He again looked down at his shoes, saying, "I haven't written any letters." I told him he was lying. He said no. Whereupon I said to him, "I'm now in a position whereby I'm asking you why you wrote the letters, and not if you wrote them." And his reply was, "Yes, yes, I wrote all those letters. I cannot tell you why. I was ill at the time."
So after his initial denials that he was the author of these letters, he then accepted that, yes, indeed he was.
Yes, exactly.
And what was his demeanour like when you first told... Yeah, what was he like when you first told him that you'd had these letters and it was a serious matter?
His knees were literally knocking. He is ashen-faced and his hands, he was fidgety with his hands. All the signs, I've done it.
And as you say, when you question him about these criminal activities, he looked away.
He would look down at his feet, and that was one of his characteristics, that whenever he was lying, he would look down at his feet. When he was telling the truth, he'd stare you straight in the eye.
And I think that's what somebody who was analysing body language would say, that was a tell. So one of Emir Owen's tells was that he used to look at his feet when he was lying to you.
Yes, he did, every single time.
The other tell was when he was telling the truth, he would stare at you, he would stare you out.
He would literally stare you out, yes.
So knowing now and having his confirmation that he is the author of those letters, what action did you take then?
I asked him where he would normally have an office or what have you, and he directed us upstairs to this, like, an attic bedroom in the bungalow. And upon entering the room, which was very small, I was first struck by the tidiness of everything being in this place. Even his sermons filed. Everything was filed and kept as if he knew he could put his hand on anything at a moment's notice. I asked him what he had up there. He said nothing. I opened like a cupboard door in the wall, and inside the cupboard wall I came across 9 paperback books, 3 hardbacks and 16 magazines. They dealt with the occult, various sexual perversions and masochistic practices. And I asked him, did he have any more? And I kept asking, did he have any more? And yes, the magazines were of male nudes. And I looked further and I asked him what else he had there. And he said nothing. There was a very small book bureau, and I removed the books on the top shelf, where I found 4 plastic boxes holding photographic slides. At random, I picked a box at random and randomly selected one slide, and I held it up to the light, and what I saw on it was a penis and scrotum on what appeared to be a plate or a tin. And it went on from there, the discovery of something far more macabre than I had ever thought I'd ever see in my service.
Of course, so just thinking how you're going to deal with this man, the start of your questioning is in relation to anonymous letters of a threatening nature, of an unpleasant nature, of a nasty nature, and now all of a sudden you're faced with this, with literature of the type that you've mentioned, and now you're looking at slides of male genitalia that he has in his possession. That's a huge swing away from what you went there in the first place.
Well, it's nobody more surprised than I was.
Well, that's a major revelation. I mean, the anonymous letters that were subject to that investigation and the serious impact that those letters were having on the recipients. But this is something else, isn't it? We're not going to make any comments or judgments about the Reverend's possession of the literature that he chose to look at and keep. The issue here is those slides, photographs of the male genitalia that has apparently been cut from a body.
I examined 2 other slides to find the subject similar in each case. I asked Owen, how is it that the privates have been detached from the deceased body in these slides? And he answered, post-mortem. I told him I've attended scores of post-mortems over the years. Never have I seen the penis and scrotum being severed from the body. Pathologists don't normally do this. And he replied, just post-mortem. His hands and knees were shaking at this time. His hands were in his trouser pockets and he kept pacing two steps forward and two steps back in the study. And I asked him, how did these slides come into your possession? And who carried out these post-mortems? I find it highly irregular that you should be in possession of such things. Emir Owen answered, I cut them off. Again looking down at the floor, this time not lying, but through shame. I said, how on earth did you do that, and where did all this take place? He answered, in a chapel before the burial. I used the knife. I asked, where is the knife now? And Owen then bent down alongside the bookcase from where I had recovered the photographic slides, and picked up a cardboard shoebox. This he handed to me. And upon opening it, I found it contained a length of cord, a sterile polypropylene syringe in sealed wrapper, length of pyjama cord, plastic syringe, one wooden handled screwdriver, a safety razor, a pair of steel handcuffs, a 6-inch kitchen knife, one blade of a bread knife, 18 inches in length, with no handle, a pair of hair clippers, a pair of sponge forceps, two pairs of dental tooth extractors, one pair of long-nosed forceps with ENT etched thereon, and one pair of suture-holding forceps with an etched in it. I asked him, will you tell me how he came about to perform the operation on the deceased? And much to my amazement, he said, I did 3 altogether. I've marked the slide boxes with their names. There's the one you've got in your hand. And he named a person, and he mentioned, and there's 2 others, naming both. You see that I marked the boxes with their names. The other boxes have names, but I didn't do anything to those. Opened the coffins and took photographs, nothing else. I told him I was taking possession of the items, and he asked me, yes, what will happen? Will I be kept? I must take possession of these and other things from the house. You have been present when I have found the magazines, books and other things. We will now put them in the boot of my car and take you to Dolgelly. His reaction was, yes, what will happen then? Will I be kept there because I have Christmas cards and presents and things to do? And my parting words to him were, in all probability, in the light of what has been found, I don't think that there is the slightest chance of you coming back here for some considerable time. Then, with Phil Edwards, we accompanied Emyr Owen to Dolgella Police Station. En route, he told me, in Welsh, I'm glad this has come out. This is a burden off my shoulders. And I asked him, would you repeat that in English for the benefit of PC Edwards? He doesn't understand Welsh. And Owen said, this has been a burden off my shoulders. I'm glad it's all over. I don't know what came over me. It's been stopped before anything worse happened.
So this is kind of a big turnaround in that we've gone from you investigating the anonymous letters and initially him denying that and then admitting that he'd sent those letters to then discovering this material, the books, the literature, and subsequently these slides, which he admits he has removed the genitals of male deceased people who he's going to be responsible for burying them, and he's done that to their remains.
That's correct, yes. On arrival at Dolgella Police Station, shortly after 10 o'clock that night, I reminded him of the caution and said, do you fully understand that? And he said, yes, same as you told me before. I want to tell you. I've been wanting to tell someone such a long time. I asked him if he wanted anything at that stage. and asked him if he wanted anyone told where he was. And his reply was, "I wouldn't mind seeing a doctor, I have a high blood pressure." He elected that the police surgeon would do, as he says, he'll do nicely. You couldn't give me a drink of water. I told him, "I'll arrange for you to have a drink of water now and a cup of tea in a minute."
Once you were back at the police station, what was your impression of Emir Owen? Was it like he said that he was glad that this was all over and he was glad that he'd unburdened himself? Did you get that impression from him?
Yes, I did. But he was a Jekyll and Hyde. He could move from one emotion to another seamlessly.
So two sides of the same,
yes,
of the same coin, really.
Yes. And in the course of conversation, he said to me, "You are now talking to Emir Dda," which translated as the good Emir. "The Emir Drug," which is the bad Emir, "has gone. You'll never see him again." And that's how he equated the situation, that he was two people, the good Emir and the bad Emir.
And it's the bad Emir that did these dreadful things.
Yes.
And it was the good Emir that was talking to
you. Yes. The bad Emir was out of control and uncontrollable.
Did you believe him at that time? Or was he trying to dig himself out of it?
No. I took it as flannel. Now then, at one point in the interview, very early point, I should add, he says, "Call me Emir." But he was trying to get on to good terms, that was, for his own benefit. But I stuck to it. Mr. Roberts, I was to him all the time.
The nature of his occupation, he'd be good at talking to people.
He would.
And thinking on his feet.
Yep.
When he's giving his sermons, yes, or whatever they did in those churches, and answering questions on the spur of the moment. So he was quickly sussing out what you were going to do and say and how he could portray himself in the best light. Would that be fair?
Yes, yes, that would be fair. His actual words to me were, "You are now talking to Emir Owen, the minister. There is also Emir Drug, the bad Emir. I had no control over him. He would descend like something black into my head, and now I do these things." And I took the opportunity then of asking, "How many times have you done these things?" "Three times, only three times. You have been to the house and found the slides. Together there's three bodies I have done," and he named them. "What did he do to each of them?" And he goes on to describe, he'd gone to the chapel at night where they lay before the burial, and he emphasised, I say at night, but it was about 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. "I would take the lid off the coffin and cut their things." And then I ask him, "Can you recall when and where these acts took place?" And in the course of that interview and later interviews, he fully admitted having removed the genitals on three occasions with three men. And he went on to add, because I had found other documents which he had written down, he had opened coffins just to photograph the deceased on three occasions. So in all, he's opened six coffins, hasn't he?
The photographs that you saw of the penis and the scrotum being cut away from the bodies, that happened on three occasions. But he then admits to you that he's undone the coffins and taken photographs of the bodies. Did you find those photographs?
I was coming to that. I didn't find those photographs. And my opinion then, as of now, was that he'd done the same to the other three, but he was scaling it down. He'd already admitted three to me, hadn't he? And he wasn't going to admit six. There was no evidence of the three,
those other
of
three,
the deceased.
Yeah.
So he said, took photographs. And yet, I didn't find any slides or printed photographs. And I went through the house like a tooth comb. And the other thing was that he had recorded himself, his voice, commenting as he was doing it.
So as he was committing this art of mutilation on these three bodies,
there was a running commentary.
He was giving a commentary?
Yes, which he recorded.
Which he recorded.
And I found that on a cassette under the stairs, which he himself told me about the following day, and I went there and recovered it.
You know, on the conversation he was recording, was he just describing what he was done, or was there a religious aspect to it?
No, no religious aspects at all.
So it was just nil. Pure brutality, basically.
Yes. He was sadistic. And in later conversation, when he mentioned something serious, he went on and said to me that had the manse been closer to the chapel, he would have taken the body home. And then went on from there. I said, when you say something worse happened, would you have killed? And he was a pause before he'd answer that. He didn't know.
I mean, it's absolutely bizarre, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, and Sally can comment, I've never heard of anything like this before. I bet you haven't.
No.
And Sally?
I've never heard of anything
like
this.
It's the first case in British legal history, hence the pondering of the charges.
And that's interesting about the charges, because when I first became aware of this case, that's the first thing that I always go to look at. What is this person charged with? So what was he charged with in relation to the mutilation of those three corpses?
Well, what the one of the main charges was mutilating a corpse contrary to common law, which I worded that one myself. The same charge was in charge 2 and the same in charge 3. Now then, he ultimately had 2.5 years imprisonment concurrent for those. And then the fourth charge was uttering threats to kill contrary to section 16, Offences Against the Persons Act of 1861, for which he had 18 months imprisonment. In total, he had imprisonment of 4 years.
So just looking at those charges, because as I was saying, that I'm always interested, that's the lawyer in me, I'm always interested in what people have been charged with. And there were certain things that went through my mind, like criminal damage, because there's no specific offence in legislation for the mutilation of a body. So I was trying to find out, you know, what could you think of? So I was thinking of criminal damage, but who owns a dead body? That was a bit of a non-starter. And then as we were chatting, I was saying to John, they've got to be, because as you charge somebody, it's either contrary to a particular piece of legislation or it's contrary to common law. And I said, these have got to be contrary to common law offences. So the wording of those offences were formulated to reflect his offending.
Yes, yeah.
So for the mutilation of the three corpses, he has one count on each. And then the fourth charge is the letter, the anonymous letter that you mentioned, that was making threats towards the granddaughter of the letter's recipient.
You know, on that particular charge, what did he actually say he was going to do in the letter?
Will kill your granddaughter. It wasn't put down that way. But it was worded in such a way that the recipient perceived that that's what he was trying to say. He didn't say it outright, but that's how she perceived it.
And why did he pick on that young lady, the daughter of the letter recipient? Do you know?
Because he believed that a family member was responsible for the killing of the sheep.
And this goes back to the beginning of our interview, doesn't it?
It goes back to the letters where he was saying the killing of the sheep was a Masonic act, and that family member happened to be a Mason.
So he was taking it out on that family
for
what he thought they'd done to the sheep.
Yes.
So they'd kill sheep, so I'll kill somebody
in
your family.
His family.
It's quite a evil thing to say and do, isn't it?
And the more you think about it, the deeper you go.
Mm.
And it gives you no direction as which way his mind is working from one day to the next.
And to a trusted member of such a close-knit community.
Yes.
So let's just think about what we've heard in the last couple of interviews with Gwyn, and let's just assimilate that information that we've got. Gwyn's investigating the anonymous letters, the sending of the anonymous letters, and now we've got the Reverend who's, we found out that he's the author, and he's also admitted sending sending those nasty letters. I mean, what's his motivation for doing something so horrible?
I mean, this is what brought us to this case, I think, isn't it, really? It was so unusual, so bizarre. You've got a pillar of the community, the Reverend, sending letters to some of his parishioners and other people, making threats and being really aggressive
putting swastikas on the letters and making references to Hitler.
I mean, what does motivate a man like that? Why has he done it?
He must have seen the hurt that those letters were causing amongst the community, because people must have been talking about them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no doubt, after he'd sent them and before Gwyn arrested him, it must have been talked about in the community, mustn't it? There must have been some, and he would have heard these things said, no doubt. But again, it beggars belief why anybody, let alone the Reverend, would send letters of that nature.
And then in the course of investigating those letters, Gwyn comes across these slides that show that male genitalia has been cut away from bodies. And then the Reverend goes on to admit that that's what he's done.
It's proper old detective work, isn't it? He's gone, and how many times has it happened to us, or has happened to us, where you go for one topic of investigation, which was the letters, and because you use your detective skills, you think, what else is the, what other evidence is the that I can back up that? And lo and behold, then you find a completely different crime, like these photographs that he had. Again, why would you do that?
And when you think about the responsible position that the Reverend's got, these were bodies that he attacked. You can't use any other word, can you? He attacked them. But the bodies were there in the chapel where he had access. Obviously, he's the Reverend. He had access. And the following day, he's due to bury that corpse, the corpse that is being kept within the church the night before the burial. What's the thought process that takes you into the church to open the coffin, to look at the body within, and then to cut away parts of that body? And not only does he do that, he then takes photographs and keeps them and stores them in his house. What's even the motivation for that? I mean, is it a trophy? Is it to be reminded of what you've done?
And also, of course, to have the front to stand in front of the family, friends and mourners of the during the service, saying whatever reverends say, you know, at these services in the church, knowing what you've done the day before. Did he get some kind of satisfaction out of that? I just, again, with the letters and this, you just think, why?
Yeah, and if he also, on three other separate occasions, he undid the coffin and photographed. He said he did the mutilation to three bodies that were ready for burial, but then he took photographs of three more. So what was the difference between mutilating those three bodies but just photographing the other three bodies?
And also recording his conversations while he was doing it.
That's right. He recorded a commentary when he was removing the genitalia from the corpse. He recorded a commentary of what he was doing,
which Gwyn found during his investigations.
That's right. And the Reverend did point him in the direction of where that recording was.
But he does give some explanation, doesn't he, that he had a good side and a bad side. You know, he was good, Amir, on his normal duties as the Reverend, but then occasionally the bad Amir appeared and he did all these things.
That's right. And one of the other things that he said was he was quite relieved that Gwyn had found out about what he'd done, because if he'd lived nearer to the chapel, that he would have taken a body home. And then Gwyn says, would you have killed? And he says, I don't know.
It seems like the letters, and we're not psychiatrists, we're not psychologists, we're lawyers and police officers, but it's not uncommon for serious offenders to start with small offences, is it? And then build up, get more daring and more involved. So were the letters the start of his criminal behaviour, and then he progressed to the bodies, the photographs, the recording of them, and as he said, possibly taking a body home, and even worse.
It could be. It could just be an escalation of your offending.
But he was examined, wasn't he, by psychiatrists and psychologists?
Yeah, while he was on remand, he was seen by at least three psychiatrists, Dr. Spry, Dr. Higgins and Dr. Lawson. And he was also seen by a psychologist who was Anne Scott Fordham. And they all did reports that were part of the file that went to court. And as usual, those sort of reports, they always include things in your background. So the fact that he was born in 1922, he was a single, he was an only child. His father was a quarryman. And when Emir was 4 years old, his father emigrated to Australia. And then very shortly after he'd arrived in Australia, he was in an accident and he died as a result of his injuries. So Emir was brought up by his mother and his grandmother. And you get that kind of background in any of those sorts of reports, don't you? And then it goes on then to give an opinion about the mental state that Emir was in. And the conclusion that all of them come to was he wasn't particularly bright, but neither was he suffering from any known mental illness or psychosis.
So is it fair to say that we just didn't know, other than what he said, he had two sides to his personality, a good side and a bad side, and that's as far as anybody could really fathom out why he did it?
Yeah, I think that's the only conclusion that you can draw, because, as I say, he certainly wasn't suffering from any type of mental illness. So he served his sentence.
Yes.
In prison,
yeah,
and was subsequently released. Did you ever meet him again after his release?
Several times. I don't think I went to Llandudno once without seeing him on the street there. And he would see me before I saw him, and he'd cross the road, shake hands, as if we were great buddies. And it's still Mr. Roberts. I was still Mr. Roberts to him.
So your interactions with him after his release were, certainly as far as he was to you, he was quite pleasant to you.
He was. And normally you had somebody that had been sent to prison. They could be nasty towards you or ignore you totally. But he wasn't. He was quite the opposite. In fact, he was embarrassing the way he'd call your name and cross the street. Now then, during this time, he had written a book, a motoring book, of driving round Gwynedd. And in that book, it so happens, he makes mention of the church in Ynyskyn here, where the offender or offenders entered the crypt. A mention is made in his book of that. Now then, it so happens that if one continues on that track, you would come out in Morfa Bychan, where his two buddies lived.
So again, this comes round full circle, that the crypt incident that you went to back in 1981 was not far from where he would walk to be with his two friends. He would pass that church and that crypt.
Yes.
And he makes mention of it in the book that he wrote about motoring round Gwynedd. And is that really quite telling?
Very telling. I'm convinced it was him went to the crypt. No question about it. Now then, a film company made a film about this case. And I went to a shop in Port Madoc. And the manageress of that shop, I'd known her many, many years, and I called in there one day, and she said, "Oh, I saw you on telly the other night." I said, "Oh, did you?" I mean, many people had told me that during the days following the transmission of that particular documentary. And I said, "Oh, yes, they used to come in here," she said. I said, "Who?" "That minister and two other men." And I always under the impression that they were a bit tiddly, that they'd been drinking. "Oh," I said, "well, why would they come in here?" "To buy candles." "What sort of candles?" "Purple candles," she said.
And round we go again, don't we?
And round we go again.
We go again.
She wasn't prepared to come out publicly about it. But that, to me, was the final stamp on it. He had been in that crypt.
Because of two facts, really. One fact that that crypt was on the
on his route
from his own house to be with his two friends. And secondly, you have him buying purple candles, and there was purple candle wax found in the crypt
and
when it had
church.
Been disturbed, and also on the altar in the church.
Yes, I'm 100% convinced he or others were responsible for what the incident at the church.
And just in conclusion, what's the aftermath in relation to the community for Emir Owen's behaviour and his impact upon the community within which he lived and worked?
There were a few people, not there themselves and now deceased, who still had faith in him. And I remember when I took him to court in Tywyn following his arrest, coming out of the court, and there was an old lady standing on the pavement, and she said to me, translated with, "Have you no shame at all arresting the minister?"
Have you no shame?
Me. Have you no shame in arresting him?
And does that reflect the attitude of that community, that close-knit religious community, and the actions that have been taken against their minister, as they see it?
Up to the point where he pleads guilty in Chester Crown Court, and all but a handful don't want to know him. Now then, representations were made to the Welsh Presbyterian Church of those who'd wed, that he'd married, if they could have their weddings blessed, and they refused to do it. There were christenings he'd done, and the same there, requests were made, could we have a blessing? It was as if a lot of people who'd been married by him or had the children baptised, as if the whole thing had been annulled as a consequence of what he was and what he did.
Yeah.
But the chapel wouldn't relent at all.
And do people within that community still talk about this, or is it something that...
No.
With the passage of time...
No. Every time a programme is made, someone, it's usually one person for a good many years, would object to the making of film, that it, or documentary, and that it was impinging on tourism in the area, which is a load of codswallop. People still came down. I mean, the people who come down hadn't even heard about it.
And I suppose within that community, it's quite a personal thing that they've put their trust in their minister. He's behaved in this way.
He betrayed them.
That is a good word, yeah. He betrayed them, which is very sad for the community.
Yes, but the ones, affected, and I suppose all the chapel-going people are affected to a certain degree. They have all now died. We are talking about an incident that happened 40 years ago.
Sure.
What kind of church was, if I ask you the question, what kind of church was the Presbyterian?
Yes,
are they
Welsh Presbyterian.
All shouting and bawling
they are different to you over the border.
Yeah.
They have a little clique who are the deacons and all the rest of it. And it's all their people are in. And then the plebs like you and I go there and give them money and all the rest of it, and we fed a lot of rubbish.
But are they quite sort of
clicky,
forceful?
Insular.
Yeah, in his sermons, would Amir come across as quite a force to be reckoned with, sort of thing?
Well, speaking across the board, I'm going back donkey's years now, growing up, anti-drink and what have you. And I was brought up in Bangor, and one of the deacons in the chapel where I went to a chapel, and then I was in the cathedral choir in Bangor, and I didn't bother with the chapel after. One of the deacons was a Mr. Jones, and he was as fat as he was tall, and he would sit there in the front, set fawr, as they call it in the Welsh, the big seat, somebody up in the pulpit there banging his fists on the Bible, condemning drink and things. And I remember as a child, 7 years old, going for a walk on a summer's Sunday night in the summer, and we went on a circular walk around the outskirts of Bangor, and we were coming down the hill, and the bottom of the hill was a pub. And of course, it was dry. They didn't have pubs open on Sundays in Wales then. And all of a sudden, as we were coming down the hill, the side door of the pub opens, This fellow with a big black hat looking in both directions goes out, and I said to my parents, I said, "Hey, that's Mr. Jones." "No, it isn't." They said, "No, it isn't. It was him. He went to the main road, turned left and went to his house, the end terrace house, 200 yards away."
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah. And at 7 years old, that's the first thing that struck me about, you know, you respected teachers, this, that and the other. And that's the first time I felt it's phony, and it stayed with me ever since.
So, to conclude, Emir has since died, hasn't he? He's not with us anymore.
Emir died on the 25th of January 2001 at the age of 78 years, and he was cremated at Colwyn Bay.
And of his two friends, are they alive still?
They are both dead.
Well, if I could just thank you, Gwyn, for talking to us about this very strange episode in the history of this area. And thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Yes, and thank you from me. It's an intriguing, unusual, unprecedented case, I would think, in legal history. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In conclusion, we'd like to thank Rhys and Gwion, who are the documentary makers, at Dockshed, based in North Wales. Their documentary, entitled The Rev, is on the Icon Film Channel and followed by all major digital platforms. It's fair to say that the documentary concentrates on the religious aspects and the sexuality of the subject. We've approached this case from a different angle and looked at the Reverend Owen's offending and criminality.
So, John, our listeners will be asking, what's next?
As usual, we are researching a number of cases, but at the moment, the case at the top of the list is a double murder in the northwest of England, a case of mistaken identity and a crime which went tragically wrong.
We'll be at CrimeCon UK, and that's the world's leading true crime event, and it's partnered by True Crime, the expert-led channel. It's happening on the 21st and 22nd of September 2024 in London. And if you're interested in true crime, there are speakers, content creators, podcasters, authors, and lots more, all from the world of true crime. There's information about those appearing, and it's been released on CrimeCon UK social channels, so keep them peeled for announcements about that content. There's different ticket options, and there's also concessions available and day tickets. So if you visit crimecon.co.uk, you can book your ticket, and don't forget to quote investigators to get your 10% discount on that ticket price.
Well, Sally, it's a very disturbing and somewhat unexpected case. It starts off with strange goings-on in rural North Wales and ultimately leads to some very disturbing and shocking events.
Our thanks, of course, go to Gwyn for giving us his time and sharing his thoughts and experiences on this case. And our thanks also go to our production team. Our editors are Angelica Dabbs and Ed Allen, and our executive producer is Pete Allen from Carrot Cruncher Media.